Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
I have to say that unlike Macy, who it took three or four phone calls and a lot of arm twisting and promises of our firstborn for Marty and me to get him to agree to come and do something he hates to do, which is talk to groups, unlike Macy, Eric Singer just said yes. We can thank Eli Evans for the connection. Eli said, you know, you can't have a program on Jewish summer camps in the South without including Camp Ramah Darom. And he made a phone call, and somebody else made a phone call, and in about 15 minutes we were on the phone with Eric, and he said yes. Eric Singer was born in Columbus to a family with deep South Georgia roots. The Singers moved to Atlanta during his teen years. Eric earned his BA in religious studies at Washington University in St. Louis and an MS in decision science from Georgia State University. He was an instructor at the National Outdoor Leadership School, a wilderness guide in Alaska, an executive in the wholesale distribution industry. He served as senior vice president of real estate for Pull Apart, Inc. in Atlanta, and is currently a partner and senior vice president at OA Development. Eric has held leadership positions in several local and national nonprofits. His proudest role, however, is as founding president of Camp Ramah Darom. In 1996, together with other volunteers from the region, he helped create a new type of institution envisioned by his father, Saul Singer, some 40 years earlier, to provide year-round Jewish experiences for youth and adults, families and congregations from across the South and beyond. I'd like to welcome Eric Singer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And, if Macy's not an accomplished speaker,
yes,
that's a scary thing. So, how do you compete with that? That's not exactly competition because it actually does tie in to what I have to say and to find out how you're just going to have to stick around. Let me pull this back up. How many of you ever heard of Ramah Darom? All right. And when you heard of it, did you hear of it, the nickname that people have affectionately given it, which is Spa Ramah? Well, it does have that nickname, and by the end of this talk, you'll understand why and how it got that name. I'm going to tell you, the title of my talk is actually, the subtitle of it is A Tale of Three Small Towns. I want to talk about our vision for what Ramah is, but by way of talking about these three small towns. And the first one I want to talk about, and I'm sorry also that Eli Evans isn't here, because he actually published this little story in the New York Times. And it relates back to Unadilla, Georgia. Unadilla, Georgia is where my father was born. My mother was from Fitzgerald, Georgia. And in Unadilla, as the story goes, and it's true, my father testified to this, my grandparents were the only Jewish family in Unadilla. Until, at one point, another Jewish family moved into the town and also started another small store, another Jew store. Everything went fine. It was no real problem. But the Yom Kippur rolled around, and my grandparents closed the store for Yom Kippur, and the Newmans, the other Jewish family, did not. The next day, the mayor and several members of the city council went to the Newman store and said, Mr. and Mrs. Newman, if you're going to be Jewish or not is really your business. But if you're going to be Jewish in Unadilla, you're going to have to close the store. that is a true story. And I introduce this small town and this story by way of talking to you about the global village. And Macy touched on it as well. In these small towns, there may have been one Jew, there might have been 10 Jewish families. But on Sundays, they didn't necessarily have a Hebrew school, but on Sundays, they would get together. They would form a much larger Jewish community. Because, you know, back in the 30s, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, people closed on Sunday. They didn't stay open all day Sunday like we do today. So all the stores closed, and they would gather in Tifton. They would gather in Osceola. They would gather in Fitzgerald, where my mother was from, and where there was actually a synagogue. And they would form a larger Jewish community. And in those places, they would suddenly be not a majority, but they would form a community and form a connections. The kids would mix. The women would cook. Maybe people would meet their future spouses. And the magic would happen when those communities got together. That's some of what we envisioned when we started Ramah Darom. That even though a lot of our participants and would come from small communities all across the South, and we draw all the way from Florida up through the Carolinas over to Oklahoma and down to Texas. When they come, and we've talked about it yesterday, when kids come from small communities and become part of something much bigger, then magic happens. The same thing is true for adults. My folks met at University of Georgia, married, moved to Columbus, Georgia, where I spent the first 11 years of my life. But when they moved there, they met a young rabbi named Cass Abelson. Cass, in 1949, and somehow everything always connects back to the Popkins, and this story has a couple of connections to the Popkins. Cass Abelson, in 1949, went to Young Judea, which at that point was at Camp Blue Star, and he was a counselor at Camp Judea. The next year, he went on and became a counselor at the new Camp Ramah in Wisconsin. He was a congregational, rabbi, a movement rabbi from the conservative movement. He'd just come out of the army and had served as a rabbi during the Korean War. He was so moved and so impressed by the power of Jewish camping that when he came back to Columbus, Georgia, he just formed an instant bond with my parents. They became very close friends, and he was so impressed that they then decided to send my sisters in the 1950s from Columbus, Georgia, up to the Poconos and to Connecticut to Camps Ramah in those two locations. I'll just add, for those of you who don't know, a little aside about Ramah. The way it's different from a lot of what we were talking about yesterday is that Ramah really believes in content. They have the sports programs, the outdoor programs, swimming, arts and crafts, all those things. But it's almost the opposite of Camp Wakanda, I think was the name. They really believe in inserting content. And their theory is that while kids are having fun, you can insert knowledge and content. It really is a Jewish educational experience. I would add that you probably learn about 5 times more during summer camp than you would all year during your regular Hebrew school. And it really is a magical sort of combination, and it worked incredibly well. So this kind of camping, I want to emphasize, is about making those connections, those community connections like people did in that global village in Unadilla. And it's also about adding content. Like I said, my sisters went in the 1950s. My parents then sent me in the 1960s to Camp Ramah. And while I was there, I bought that, we talked yesterday about the cult of the vigorous life. I bought it hook, line, and sinker. And it was at Ramah. Most of my experiences happened with my friends and in group situations. But one day I was off by myself and had just an epiphany that what I wanted to do was teach people about the outdoors. It was just a love of mine. And so even my experience going off to Alaska and teaching outdoor experiences really had its origins at Jewish summer camp. The next story that I want to tell you about a little town is Elkins, West Virginia. Elkins, West Virginia is the home of just an incredible place called the Augusta Heritage Festival. At the Augusta Heritage Festival, it lasts 5 weeks. Each week is a different musical theme week. Sometimes they have two theme weeks at once. And you come and you stay at the Davis and Elkins College. The college is closed for the summer. And you use the dormitories and other facilities there. And you are with just some of the most inspiring educational personalities that you can imagine. These are professional musicians, but not just professional musicians. They're really people who are love to share. And I went there, I'm guessing now it was probably 10 or 12 years ago, with two friends of mine. And we kept kosher. We had read in the brochure in the catalog that there was going to be a man named Sugar Mike McQuaid teaching about barbecue up in the mountains of West Virginia. And we were interested in blues camp. That's the reason that I played the harmonica for you. I play blues harmonica. My other friend did. Another friend played guitar. We wanted to go to Blues Week at Augusta. But we heard about this, you know, what could be better than to have this delicious barbecue? And he was going to do a party for everybody during that week. And the class was going to cook barbecue, and they were going to have it all for us, available for us. So we had this conundrum. We decided to bring our own Cornish hens, kosher Cornish hens. They were slaughtered. They were already frozen. We bought these Cornish hens. We put them on ice. We put them in a cooler. We flew up to Pittsburgh. When we got to Pittsburgh, we immediately found some more ice, put them back on ice, schlepped them down to Elkins, you know, the mountains of West Virginia and Elkins. And we for a day, we decided what we were going to do. Finally, we worked up the whatever to go talk to this big guy, you know, great big guy with a beard and wearing the white T-shirt with, the apron, the tattoo on his arm. And we tried to explain to him what it was we were looking for. We have a special dietary requirement. If you wouldn't mind, we would really like to participate, but we need our hens cooked. If you wouldn't mind putting them on the other side of the grill. He's looking at us. He's sort of cocked his head. He's looking at us, and we're talking. We're probably over-talking this thing to death. And we finally shut up, and he looked at us and said, "Boys, I'll do it, but I've got to tell you, it's going to be on the kosher side of Trafe." He knew that it wasn't going to be kosher. It seems going to be on the same grill. The reason I introduced this story and the other story is that Elkins, West Virginia was a place where we had content. We were exposed to exceptional educational personalities. People who, when you got up with them in the morning, you talked harmonica. When you went to, you stayed up with them late at night playing music. All day was filled with practice, with learning. You didn't necessarily get better at Elkins, but for the next 6 months after you went home, you worked on it, you worked on it. It instilled inspiration into you. And it's the stories that you come away with. You bring the content with you, but what really fuses these things in your mind are some of these often funny stories, sometimes poignant stories. And I got to tell you, my harmonica playing just took a tremendous, leap after going there and being inspired. The same thing happens in a Jewish environment. And Ramah, all of the Ramah camps are known for this. We really invest heavily in bringing outstanding educational personalities. And when you're in that environment, and when you have structured learning along with a lot of fun, and when your rabbi is also playing basketball with you or taking you on a canoe trip, it just makes a huge impact, and it's an inspirational experience. Again, I told you that the Popkins always seem to be involved. When we first started Ramah Darom, and I have a parallel experience to what Macy was saying. For some reason, in our case, it was probably more the dysfunction of our movement. The people from New York and the United Synagogue just somehow didn't want us to have a camp in the South. And I have documents, I brought them with me just to show anybody who'd be interested, from 1956 when my father tried to start a Ramah camp. And back then they were focused on a children's camp entirely. But I have those documents where they found a camp. It was called Camp Junaluska. Some of you probably still exists. They found several pieces of real estate. I have all the real estate research. They did a whole feasibility study, exactly the same thing we did in 1996. And they were rejected by the National Ramah Commission in New York. It was not time for it. We don't think you can raise the money, $250,000 in 1956. You don't have the population. We're more focused right now on establishing a camp in the Berkshires. You know, and that's what they did. It was 40 years between then and when we established the camp in the South. And I got to tell you, we had the same experience all over. The people from New York were giving us a hard time. And to my great pride, the vice presidents at the convention in Savannah, where this whole thing sort of came to a head, took the people from New York, looked them straight in the eye, and said, if you don't want your grandchildren to go to Ramah camp, that's fine. But ours are. And either this man, it was me, is allowed to speak on this lectern and tell us about what he's doing, or we're going home. And that happened. And that same kind of experience is what it takes. And that's what happened. And that's how we came into existence, by a grassroots movement to build something important and different here. Now, what is the difference? The difference is sort of combines the two stories that I was telling you about. It's a matter of bringing together people and forming a global community. And in our case, it's from the South, but it's also from all over. And it's also about infusing those programs and that time with content and with meaning. Let me tell you about some of the things that we're doing. We have, we have a Passover retreat that at this point has 360 people year after year. And that's sold out. For us, our camp in Rabun County, Georgia, that's the third town, is Clayton, Georgia. I told you this is a town of three, tale of three small towns. Clayton, Georgia. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. If you haven't been there, my goal for this whole talk is to get you enthused and get you to come, because there are things that you can do there. There are programs for people our age that are just inspiring. And it is a gorgeous, gorgeous place. It's a $20 to $23 million facility. It's in a beautiful, beautiful setting. We have an adult capacity, it's an adult mixed capacity of families, of all, you know, people of all ages, of about 360 people. During the summer, there's about probably 700 people there. And we have 360 people for Passover. We have grandparents, parents, and children. And it's sold out every year within 1 to 2 months after the retreat is over. It's sold out for the next year. We, at these retreats, this is addressing the content issue, we have people like Joseph Telushkin. He's an Orthodox rabbi. We have Harold Kushner, a conservative rabbi. We have had Lawrence Kushner, a Reform rabbi, whereas the summer camp is sometimes a conservative movement operation. The rest of what we do is really pluralistic and for people of all ages and in all stages. We do a winter family camp so that people with young kids can take that sort of dead zone in December and, believe it or not, come up to the mountains in North Georgia and have a great winter camp experience with their kids. We have an annual women's retreat. We host weddings and B'nai Mitzvah. We have synagogue retreats. We partner with Teva to provide Jewish environmental training for day schools. We host USY groups, Jewish agency programs for Shlichim. Those are the Israeli kids who come and work in everybody's summer camps during the summer. I just want to say that what really distinguishes our faith, the Jewish religion, is that we are really a faith and a religion that believes in becoming. we are partners with, we view ourselves as partners with God in creation and tikkun olam, in repairing the world. At Ramah, we don't so much focus on Jewish continuity, because continuity is a noun. We prefer to focus on the verb, on continuing. We don't believe that Jewishness is something that we just take in a hypodermic needle and insert into our children. That the real key to Jewish continuity, if you will, is continuing to be Jewish, to continue to become in that act of becoming. And that is why we provide these kind of programs. But it's not just that. We invite you, if you have programs, if you have ideas, Ramah Darom is the place where those kinds of things can happen. And you're welcome to speak to me, to contact me, go to our website. We love new programs, and we're all about creating ways which people can connect with their Jewishness at Ramah Darom. So that is what we are. It's about the global village. It's about creating places where people can come together, form connections, make these memories, and make up these stories, these Jewish stories and funny stories that cement their memory, where there's content. And this is our mission statement: Ramah Darom, exceptional experiences in Jewish living and learning for youth and adults, families, and communities. We believe in exceptional experiences. You go and you're exposed to great harmonica players, you learn how to play harmonica. You're exposed to exceptional Jewish educators, you are enthused and motivated to become a deeper and more meaningful Jew. If you're a more meaningful, deep and meaningful Jew, that is in turn translated to everybody you know and to your kids, etc. I appreciate this opportunity, and I wanted to tell you, by the way, we also run a summer camp. Thank you.
Q&A?
I was looking for Macy.
What is your website?
Okay.
The website is ramahdarom.org. And just as a throw out, one thing I think everybody in here would really be interested in is Limud. Have you ever heard of Limud? It's Limmud. It's a great program. It's, to say it's non-denominational is an understatement. It's the full gamut of Jewish experiences, Jewish cooking, Jewish music, it could be politics, etc. All of the presenters are volunteers. It happens every year at Ramah Darom over the Labor Day holiday. It's a long weekend. It's a lot of fun. People drink schnapps, you know, play music, learn from each other, and I would encourage you to look into it. It's just a lot of fun, and you'll connect with people from all over. Passover, we have people coming from all over, Jews coming from all over the world and all over the South, from England, from Israel, from Seattle, and from all over the South. It is a wonderful experience.
If Darom is south, what does Ramah mean?
Height. It's a plateau. So the Golan south Heights are called Ramat Golan.
Uh-huh.
So a high place.
And Macy just walked back in. So if anybody has a question, to direct to him as well.
Yeah, I have one.
Okay.
I think it was in Jess you were saying that Teach for America, Jewish Teach for America, is for the fellows. We in Florence have been members of the ISGL for several years, and the kids are amazing. What makes these talented kids do this for a couple of years? Is there really, they just get paid a certain amount? What's the incentive to get these kids there?
It's a fabulous question. This is the thing, and I think Eric and I would agree with this 1,000,000%. There's so much inventory of Jewish kids graduating from college as there are across the American landscape of kids graduating from college that want to do something before a lot of them go to graduate school. The highest percentage of an ethnicity that applies to be in Teach for America are Jewish kids. And a lot of them get turned down. Now, I'm not saying we get the rejects, because even the rejects are great, but what I'm saying is we could, and that's what we're trying to do, and that is raise these kids, because they've got these role models that we see at all of these camps that are counselors. So they want to do something for a couple of years. So it's a 2-year fellowship. Yeah, it's a fabulous job. We pay them $250,000 a year. And they go it's a 2-year thing, and they're each assigned to 6 to 8 congregations. And they go in, if it's a congregation without a rabbi, they will conduct services according to the tradition of that congregation, not one that we peddle and say, this is the only way to do it. We respect those traditions. So this is one of those things with this year-round camping that we're working on the whole thing. So the Ramahs and the Reform movements and the Young Judeas and so on could start turning out kids. My goal, which I didn't get a chance to talk because that mean lady up there cut me off, is to be put out of business. I think Eric feels the same way, because we have similar stories about our movements of not knowing who their constituency is. And when I left the Reform movement to do this, 65% of the Reform movement's congregations were 250 families or less, according to their due structure MUM, Managed Student Union Membership. So the story is that we just get phenomenal applicants from across the area. These are mostly not Southern kids. And we have a sheet of the 29 former fellows, because we went from 2 to now we have 9, and where they are, how many have gone on to rabbinic school, how many in Jewish education, Jewish communal service, etc. So there's an inventory of young people out there that are dying to get involved, and those who are coming from Ramah, Reform Movement, Young Judea, Jewish camping in general, and also private camping that are what we call camps for Jewish kids, like Blue Star. It's not a Jewish camp, it's a camp for Jewish kids, because 95% or more of the population are Jewish. Those kids want to do something when they finish college, and so it's an easy access target.
Let me just mention, by the way, the person who works for me, who's incredibly good, is Mark. Mark is a graduate of the ISJL program. Before Mark Swick, we had Mimi Lewis, who's also very, very much involved and worked with Macy. So it really is an incredible resource. And I just want to say, in general, in response to Diane's question, we run the Jewish Studies program in terms of hirees, with young kids who graduated college who want to spend a year or two before they settle in on a career or graduate school, or they're a little bit lost and don't know what to do. So our student life component is always people with kids fresh out of college, work for 2 or 3 years, and then move on to, we meet with now in law school at Penn. So anyway, it is a huge resource, something that you really can tap into. And I want to thank Macy for sending us Mark.
And me too.
Are these fellowships only for young people in the southern region, or is it national?
No, I would like for it to be a national program. And that's what, there's some conversations maybe going on that might let that happen. But our fellowships are for our 13 states that use, these are education fellows. So they are devoted only to our education department and delivering that curriculum and training the teachers. They're on the phones with them in the week. They physically visit. They're not there to teach. They're there to help the teachers and to connect them to a 13-state network.
Macy, I just want to say, listening to you, listening to Eric, makes me feel a lot better about the Pew Report.
Well, the great thing about the Pew Report, we just didn't have a chance to talk about it. There's so much for us to talk about in general, but the great thing about the Pew Report, if you read, the real outstanding piece was that 95%, 96% of the people that were interrogated showed pride in being Jewish, proud of being Jewish. So the unaffiliation rate, or so on. I mean, if you looked at the study and why it happened, why did it happen? Because the 1990 study was a wake-up call. A lot of things happened as a result of that. 2000 was the next wake-up call, but it was had not gotten any better. There's not a 2010, because the handwriting on the wall already was. So this is 2000 and what year? 13. They didn't commission one. So that's how Pew, they asked Pew to do it, and Pew did it because they were an outside resource using Steve Cohen and all these other resources. And all those things are not shocking to us. We know my own three children. I have one in Boston who was the director of the Mitzvah Project of Mayan Chaim. If any of you know that fabulous program in Boston, she worked inner city. She's now going back into the inner city. They do not belong to a congregation, but they are doing Jewish things all the time. One of the things is dollars. Another thing is they just are, they're both camp products, one from Young Judea, one from the Reform Movement, two camps. My middle child, same thing. They do stuff. They don't belong. They live in Atlanta. They do lots of stuff. And the youngest one's very active with her child, two children, in a congregation. So I have three raised in a Jewish home, went to Jewish camping, and can lead services. Most of our kids that come out of our camping programs can do this, and the congregations themselves, I hate to say this because Eric and I didn't rehearse this part, is we, the camp director, did a terrible job of back to reality, of not helping the kids prepare to get back to the fact that the synagogue from where they mostly came is not the enemy. And we, as the camp directors in the Reform Movement, because I was a part of that collegial group for 30 years, I thought about this all the time. We've got to find a way back to reality. It can't be at the expense of the congregation. These beautiful role models could go out and pick up a cricket and a blade of grass and have a guitar and say, listen, look, sing, that's God. And you go back into the four walls, and we didn't make a great transition, and we still haven't been able to do that, except that the seeds we planted that Eric's talking about and I'm talking about, the seeds we planted are that group of 20, 30, and 40-year-olds that everybody's looking for.
Yes.
The Marcus Foundation followed up with some of our leaders, our counselors, our staff who have gone on and now are in their mid to late 20s, got 25. They wanted to do a focus group and find, I'm not sure what their goal was, but they wanted to talk to them. Got 25 of those kids together in Atlanta. They did a focus group. None of them, these are our leaders. These are our instructors, our young, none of them belong.
I was at the one that Young Judea. Jay asked me to be at that one. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. Of that group of 25 or so leaders, only one or two.
But they're involved.
Involved. Very much. Jewish, but that's not good for synagogues. You know, people want their synagogues when they need them. That's the thing.
But there's a way to turn that tide.
We need to start working on
that. And many of us, by the way, we're 20, 30, and 40-year-olds ourselves. And their generation of our age group was wondering what's going to happen to that group. So some of this is not new.
Yeah, but when I was 20 and 30, well, out of school, I belonged to a synagogue. I always did. I guess because I grew up in a small town and we had to drive 20 miles. And the mere fact that there was one where I was living, it was just such a joy. Plus, the synagogues made it very affordable back then. I have no clue what they do now, but they encouraged it and whatever we could pay because they wanted the membership. They knew that's how they were going to, you know, grow their leaders. Yes. I have nieces and nephews who are in Washington. They're in all the big cities. None of them belong to the synagogues. No. So I understand that trend. So, anything else? If not, yes.
I have a question for Eric. Eric, you started by saying you really wanted to give children experience the outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little bit more about that? And I'm thinking specifically, is the children's experience of the outdoors also an experience in education about conservation and preservation? Or to use kind of the language of current environmental movement, you know, West Virginia, gorgeous mountain state, but also has terrible problems with water quality in some areas, mountaintop removal by coal. And I'm just wondering, is there a kind of an an educational, when I look at, you kind of, it's true that Jewish, young Jewish people are you know, the numbers in Teach for America who apply are disproportionate. The numbers of young, for example, Jewish children who apply to environmental studies programs at universities is way out of proportion, you know, to numbers in population too. And so there's some link to be made of kind of kids and the outdoors and that experience. And I was just wondering if you'd say something more about that outdoor experience.
Well, they really are connected. And while I'm talking, I also want to said I would explain why it's part of mine. So, and I didn't do that. In my experience at Knowles, I mean, you teach people who really come for the outdoor experience. They don't come for the conservation experience, you know, for conservation education. I think the two are linked. I'm not sure that we do as good a job at Ramah as we could. Part when we were talking yesterday about values education at summer camps, yes, we do that because we are Jewish and we have Jewish values, but also kids are sponges for these kinds of issues. Kids are naturally rebellious. Kids want to fix things. They grow up and see the things that are wrong with our world, both in terms of social justice and in environmental, not just environmental justice and also environmental conditions. So I think that this is an opportune time to teach while you're teaching about how to backpack and how to enjoy the outdoors. It's also a time to teach kids about the politics of the outdoors because it's reality. It's fine to view the outdoors as a place to escape to, and it is to some degree escapism, and I know, but it's also only there because people, when they're not backpacking, come home, get involved, they talk to their senators, they get politically involved, they write letters, and they advocate for the outdoors, and it's both a conservation issue for reasons of beauty and for natural resources, and it's also an environmental justice issue because people are made, as you were referring to it with mountaintop removal, they're made to live with pollution and the results of pollution. So it's another one of those topics and areas because young people are there. It's just a great way to latch into young people to talk about environmental issues as well as other political issues, social justice, environmental justice, etc. And it's a great time. When I am back in Atlanta, the thing I do now is I work with a kid named Adam Griff who started his own outdoor program, Adama Adventures, and he does that. He used that as part of his curriculum. It's sort of a camp without walls, a Jewish camp without walls. But just, I said I would explain why Spa Ramah. We built this place for adults. And that's, you know, it happens to be nicer than your typical summer camp. But we didn't do it because we wanted to spoil kids and build them a really nice spa-like summer camp. We did it because the cabins are built to be two family or four family units where there can be a men's restroom, women's restroom, families can be in there, the parents can have their own private room, kids can sleep in the middle, etc. It's got real walls with insulation so that we can heat them a little bit during the winter. It's got a dryer so that we can dry wet towels, etc. We also have about 40, and we're, no, not 40, about 50 hotel type rooms with double queen beds for adult retreats. We're about to build, God willing, another facility with more of those type hotel type rooms. So it really is set up. We first called this the Center for Southern Jewry, and we've referred to it as a spiritual home for the Jews of the South and as an educational village. It's all those things. So y'all come.
Very good. All right, well, I think we stand adjourned.
Yeah.
Thank you all for coming.